Welcome, welcome, Raoul, to this cafe club. Well, as usual, notification. As usual, a short CV about our speaker today. Raoul graduated at the Institut d'Astrophysique Spatiale in Orsay in 2016. Working on a Planck and Herschel surveys. Then he moved to the Dark Cosmology Center in Copenhagen for a couple of years, and then he joined in January 2019 as postdoctoral researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics in Garching, where he works in the group led by Sherry Suyu, becoming a specialist of lensing, and today with a special emphasis on deep learning. I invite everyone to interrupt Raoul at any time to ask questions. Let's go. Thank you, Raoul.
Thanks a lot for the introduction and thanks for the opportunity. So I will talk today about cosmology and stellar physics with strongly lensed supernovae. I will try to keep it short enough, but yeah. So I will start with an introduction about the concept. So first, you probably all know about time delay cosmography already, but I will just remind you how it works. In time delay cosmography, we need a time variable source like a quasar or a supernova being in a host galaxy in the background, lensed by a foreground structure and lensed into multiple images. And so the multiple images will appear, the light curve from all of them will appear with some time delays due to the different light path that they experience. And so the time delays can be measured on a human time scale with telescopes. And the good news is that these time delays, delta T, they are related to the time delay distance and to the gravitational potential of the lens. And so they can be used to measure the cosmic expansion rate and the H-naught value, because the time delay distance is primarily proportional to 1 over H-naught, and with some weak dependencies on other cosmological parameters. So this is the idea brought by Rezdal in 1964. And it's a very good way to measure the H-naught value in a very independent way from other probes, because you just need, you need a very good model of the lens mass distribution, and then you can infer a cosmological distance from that with the time delay value in just a one step. So this technique is very important in the current tension that you all know about the H-naught value that is inferred from the CMB on one side and from the early late time universe, on the other side, from the cosmic distance ladder methods and other methods. And so this discrepancy, which is now growing to 5 sigma, according to the last papers, is very interesting, but we still need to make sure it's not due to systematic errors, in which case, and to do that, we need new and independent measurements of H-naught. If it's not due to systematics, it could suggest a new physics beyond the standard lambda CDM model. And so this is really important to check. And to do that, so the first efforts were based on lens quasars, especially in the Holico program led by Sherry Suyu, which is for the final release using these six lens quasars, using the monitoring of the light curve for many years, mainly from the Cosmograde program, as you can see here, to measure the time delays. And so this program led to the following constraints on H-naught with 2.4% precision as the black joint posterior shown here that combines the posterior from all the different systems. So this analysis was relying on very good data, of course, space-based imaging, IFU spectroscopy to constrain the lens environment, to constrain the external the external convergence value to make sure the mass shift degeneracy is constrained well enough. It's also using the best parametrization of the lens mass profiles we can admit nowadays, But given the fact we know that the parameterization of the lens mass profile has some effect on the output, there are new steps to address, and there are new other systematics to address. So we need to go beyond the work from Holikau, and to move, probably best would be to move to lens supernovae. Why? So why is that? It's because the lens supernovae have a lot of advantages compared to lens quasars. So first, they have characteristic light curves that are shorter than lens quasars. They have, for the type 1a supernovae, they have a standardizable peak luminosity that can be used as an input, as a constraint. And also, very importantly, so the supernovae, as you can see here in this example, the multiple images appear one after the other, but after, let's say, 1 year, they all fade away. And so you can see the host galaxy very well with Hubble, for example, and use that to constrain the lens mass potential. In addition, when the supernova fade away, you can also acquire 2D spectroscopy of the lens, which turns out to be extremely important, not only to break parameter degeneracies, but also to reduce the dependence of H naught on the parameterization of the lens mass potential. So these 2D kinematics are quite central here. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Raul, are you referring to supernovae type 1a?
In this case, we are referring to all types. So I was mentioning type 1a's, where the peak luminosity can be used as an input, of course, but we can also, of course, do the same with type 2.
Okay. Even though they are not as standard candles as the type 1a. Okay.
Yeah. Indeed. I will show later the difference. But the advantage in both cases is that you have light curves that are better known with models and also much shorter. And so, as I said, that they all fade away in all cases after a few months, which help a lot. So the challenges are the fact that they are very rare and that you have microlensing from stars in the foreground lens galaxy. But even with that, you can expect to have very good precision on an H naught inference in the long run. Actually, the other step and other issue we can tackle with that is the progenitor problem of supernovae. Although I'm not an expert, it's quite clear, I think, that even though the type 1a, for example, supernovae are widely used in cosmology, their progenitors is still debated. We still don't know whether the single degenerate, double degenerate scenario, or other models are really the explanation for their progenitors, because we mainly miss the early phase observations of the supernovae after explosion. There are very good data now in imaging, but to disentangle the models, it's much better to go in spectroscopy, and especially in the rest frame UV. Essentially, without lensing and without these time delays, you cannot really do that, either because with HST you have too long triggering times, or from the ground you cannot really observe the UV well enough. And with lens supernovae, we have the good hope that with good time delays, we can, from the first image, predict the reappearance of the next images and trigger these kind of observations exactly at the time we need them, within a few hours after explosion. So this is the second aspect. Now I will just mention briefly the only three lens supernovae that are known to date with resolved multiple images. The first is on the left, is supernova Rezdal that you all know, behind MAX 1149, that was widely used to test lens model predictions, including with a lens tool at LAM and other teams. And so the image 1.3 was the one appearing according to, more or less according to the predictions of models in 1 year after the images in, here in the spiral galaxy here, 1.1, in 15, sorry. And so this system was used to infer H naught, as I will show after. The other system behind a lens cluster is the supernova Requiem that was published this year, that was found here in this system as the point sources here, here, and here that were in imaging from HST in 2016 and disappeared in 2019. And from these only two epochs, so the authors of Rodney 2021 could predict that very likely the next appearing image is on the other side and should appear around 2040. So hopefully we can do more in the meantime, in 20 years with new systems. Then the last one is the Supernova IPTF 16GEU that is found by magnification. It's a type 1A that is too bright to be associated with the galaxy at redshift 0.4 in the center, which made the authors think that it's probably lensed. And when they had higher resolution data like this image, they really could resolve the different multiple images of the supernova and could confirm the system and study it in detail. Although the time delays are a bit too short to measure H0 on this one, but you can still do some other studies like the dust extinction in the lens and these kind of things. So here, I go back to supernova Rezdal, where I would like to mention that Grillo et al. Already did some inference of H0 based on this system, although the time delays are still not fully published. So Grillo et al. Show that if you assume the current time delay of 345 days, assume that the final precision is about 3% on this measurement, which is not the case right now. But as a forecast, when you combine this with the good lensing models based on all the multiple images in this system, you can actually forecast the precision of H0 of about 6% in flatland ACDM, showing that even in these complex lens clusters, you can have some good constraints. And we can likely hope to do better in galaxy scale lenses in the future, where the lens models are a bit easier to constrain. So now I would like to mention results from HolySmog, so which is the program I'm involved in Garching. So we have over 15 members, and here are my main four collaborators for the next results. So I would like to mention the results on the forecast we made for LSST on the searches and also on the follow-up plans. So finding these lens supernovae is actually very complex. There are only three known, and in the future, we typically need to wait for LSST in 2 years. That is, it will be deep enough that we'll image the full southern sky very quickly, very deep, to hope to find a substantial number of systems. So the predictions are like a few hundred systems in total for the 10-year survey, and let's say about 100 useful ones for cosmology. But in the meantime, before 2024, we already start and test our tools on TTF, which is a bit too shallow, but should hopefully find maybe one lens supernovae for the whole duration of the survey. So we try to find it, but it's quite hard. So the first part is to study and make sure we can really use these systems to tackle the progenitor problem that I mentioned by studying the early phase spectroscopy of the supernova. The problem is that you have the microlensing from stars in the foreground lens, so that affect the different images. And so we tested in this first paper, HolySmog 1, the effect of microlensing by using different progenitor models for the supernova to describe the variations of the supernova in time, wavelength, and spatial coordinates, and to compute the different microlensing maps, combine all together, and see the distortions. Here you can see in the plots that the distortions in the spectrum for this model at each epoch is very minor in the up to 10 days in the rest frame, then increases. So you can see that the 2 sigma range is always below 10% and the 1 sigma is below 1%. So the distortions are totally minor in the very early phases, which is a very good news for us and confirm that we can probably use these systems to constrain the progenitor of supernovae. So this is confirmed with 4 different models in total that should span the variety of current models that we have in the community. And after that, so we forecasted what H0 constraint we could get on LSST, assuming a very realistic sample of 20 lens supernovae of type 1A in this case, with good time delays, good data obtained, etc. Realistic inference of microlensing, of line of sight structures, and all these kind of problems we can have. And with this realistic sample, we constrain the time delay distance and the angular diameter distance to the lens in, let's say, with 5 to 6% uncertainties per system, which, when combined together, would give this constraint on H naught in flat lambda CDM, which is about 1.3% precision. So this is really reassuring and making us confident we can continue to pursue the search and the analysis to get these kind of samples. How to get these kind of samples? I would like to mention the searches. So the first approach we are taking is to find all static lenses on the sky in the north right now and then in the south to grade all galaxies to assign a lens score, let's say, and wait for a supernova to explode in the background host. So right now we are waiting for these kind of alerts in TTF, and we are searching for the static lenses in PanSTARRS, which is a survey that is covering the whole northern sky with a homogeneous depth. And to do that, we of course need deep learning to get rid of all the contaminants and to analyze quickly and classify quickly the 3 billion sources in the full northern sky detected in PanSTARRS. And after applying two different networks on the photometry and then on images, we get about 10 to the 4 candidates. So this is good for us because this gives only, let's say, one alert matching these candidates per month, which is an extremely low number, and we can analyze visually and discuss together to decide whether or not we trigger follow-up and confirmation. So the network here, of course, was used also to select static strong lenses for the community to be analyzed, to be followed up in spectroscopy. But we also realized that by doing the visual inspection of all candidates, that the contamination is quite high in this neural network selection. And so if we would apply this network to LSST in the future, we would get extremely high number of candidates. That would get a lot of matches per night, a few hundred probably, that is quite infeasible to analyze. So we decided to go forward and to improve the neural network selection of static lenses. So in machine learning, in deep learning, usually you have this kind of type domain adaptation issue where you will train the network, let's say on simulations, you will find perfect performance, and then you will move to the real survey. And you will find a crop performance because of the domain adaptation issue, where you have more contaminants in the real survey, for example. And to really address that, we tested all the networks in real data from HSC survey, which is very deep, very good imaging quality, and probably very close to what we will get from LSST. And we found out that by adapting mostly the training data set, designing better the simulations with different parameter distributions, we can reduce the contamination by two orders of magnitude, which is extremely promising for us, because we think that with such a reduction in contamination, we can probably use these new networks directly on LSST in 2 years. We expect these networks would select about 250,000 candidates in LSST. While we expect only 400,000 real galaxy lenses there. So the contamination is not that dramatic. And by combining that with the alerts, we expect that we would get only a few or maybe a few 10 matches per night that we could also analyze in the future. But to complement that, we are also investigating how to pursue the development of neural networks to analyze now the time series images from LSST in the future to get really to use all the information there in LSST. And of course, again, we apply this network to get new static lenses for the community again, which is always interesting, and the results are in this paper. Now in the, let's say, 4 minutes, maximum 5 minutes, I will mention the follow-up. How do we think it's best to follow up lens supernovae? So first, if we focus on LSST, so there was the paper by Simon Huber in our group in 2019, where he was comparing the different strategies from observing strategies from LSST. and how these different strategies would, how many good time delays they would lead for the analysis of H-naught and etc. So the different strategies that were discussed in the past years are all these ones. So it doesn't matter which name is that. But as you can see, with only LSST, you can get only over 10 years, only a few systems with good time delays. So this is a kind of disappointing. So if you then end up changing the strategy and using LSST only for discovery, and a follow-up on, let's say, on 2-meter telescope to measure the time delays, you can increase the number of good systems by a substantial factor, let's say to about 20 good systems over 10 years. So this is a lower limit because this is only considering, again, the type 1A and the type 2 are also interesting, but these forecasts are only for the type 1A. I would like to mention that the forecast also include, of course, the effect of microlensing, which is a bit tricky, and all of that is should be as realistic as possible. Yeah.
I'm sorry, can you remind which is the field of view of the Rubin Observatory?
It's a few 10 square degrees, I think. It's a very large field of view. It's imaging the full southern sky in a few nights, I think. But very deep, down to 24 magnitude per epoch, which is really this limit of the imaging depth per epoch that is really relevant for us. Mm. But also the cadence, the number of bands that are used per night to observe the same field, let's say, and also the cumulative season length, let's say, how many epochs you get for a given field of view per year. And so all of these factors are really dominating the number of systems with good time delays in the end. So these are the results from this paper. And let's say again, the main result is really that you need follow-up to get good time delays, and also that you need systems with longer time delays of 20 to 25 days to get really good constraints on cosmology. After that, so Zeman again in our group, in OLISTMOX 3, shows and constrain the bands that are really useful for getting these time delays, again in the presence of microlensing that complicates everything. The good news is that actually in the early expansion phase of the supernova within 3 weeks, let's say in the rest frame, the supernova profile are the same between all bands. So this is a kind of achromatic expansion phase. And if you then use color curves instead of light curves during this phase, you can get rid of the effect of microlensing pretty much perfectly. This is the idea put by Goldstein 2018, and that Zeman and others in our group confirmed recently with different models and very thorough analysis of different assumptions. I would like to illustrate this effect here on these light curves. So these are six different light curves with four different models of the supernova progenitors, again for type 1As. The vertical lines are the duration of the achromatic phase here. So left of the vertical lines, you can really use the variations of the light curve to measure the time delays. So you can see here that between the different color curves, the choice of filters, and between the different models, you will shift the position of the vertical line quite a lot, but you have at least, let's say 20 rest frame days here to measure on the left, the time delays quite well. So these six color curves, they have strong enough variations of the curves left to the vertical lines that should be good enough to measure the time delays. So this is in the rest frame, and if you now move to the observer frame for a typical lens supernova at redshift 0.5, you will need to observe at least in R, I, and Z bands to get good time delays, and ideally also to combine with the near-infrared imaging. So this is also convincing and ensuring that we can likely minimize the effect of microlensing well enough to use these systems with long time delays for cosmology and stellar physics. I will very, very quick on the last two slides, 2 minutes, to say that when you get this data, when you get the follow-up, and especially for the study of early supernova phases, you need to predict the reappearance of the supernova images with very quick lens models. So usually the lens modeling, like with LensTool, is done via MCMC sampling, can be very long. And so we decided to also push for the development of deep learning methods for lens modeling. So that's the work led by Stefan Schutt in NodeSmokes4, who developed very good and very realistic simulations to train these neural networks, and who tested these neural networks on HST data again to prepare for LSST. And he showed that the performance on this ground-based imaging are good enough to model the systems, for example, in the HN radius range from 1 to 3 hexagons. You can recover the value along the 1 to 1 line with some scatter, of course, because you use ground-based imaging, which is not ideal for that, but it's convincing. So Stefan showed that the results are stable even when the lens images are a bit fainter. So the results are stable as a function of the source brightness. And also that these predictions, they translate into good predictions on the image positions and time delays. So these models, based on deep learning, can do predictions within 1 second that can actually be very useful for us to predict the next appearing supernova images to follow up the observations we want. So this is again very promising for the future. And now we just need to either be lucky to find a new system in ZTF, as I mentioned, or wait for LSST in 2 years probably to really pursue all of that and to address all the scientific questions we have in mind. So here are the conclusions. I think I will just stop here and just remind quickly that we anticipate 1% precision almost in flat lambda CDM on H0 in the LSST era, and that all the microlensing effects can probably be minimized by doing strategic observations to probe the early supernova phases with a follow-up spectroscopy. So thanks a lot.
Thank you. Also,
if you have any questions, I would be happy.
Thank you, Raul, for a very nice talk. Any comment or question? Yeah, please, Rafael.
Hi, salut, Raul, everyone.
Salut.
I would have a lot of questions. Thanks for the nice talk. So I was wondering whether the plan for the 2 meter telescopes kind of class of telescope for additional interleaved observations in between LSST frames, is it already in place? You have a strategy for that? Do you have some facilities that are foreseen for such a follow-up?
Thanks for the question. And it's first I would like to mention that the strategy we put is very realistic, is only observing in 3-band down to 24 magnitude. That is entirely feasible with a 2-meter telescope. And so right now we are coordinating with the other team that we of course know well in EPFL, doing still the monitoring of lens quasars with a 2.2-meter telescope, Euler telescope in La Silla. And so that would of course be a good way to measure the time delays right now if we have a good system right now. And in the future for LSST, since we expect to have at least a few 10 systems over 10 years, we need some good facility and some access. And so this is under debate, under discussion, but I think there are good plans to have a facility that would be dedicated to that only, with some maybe peripheric science goals. I don't know which are the latest status, but this is mainly a discussion between Fred Courbin in PFL and Sherry, but there are some plans and some ideas.
Do you have a rough idea of the minimum thing that you would require for such follow-up?
Good question. No, the thing I think is not the main issue, it's really the depth. So first, maybe I didn't mention well enough, but all these studies and all these systems here we consider are with image separations above one hexagon. Why? It's because we really need longer time delays of at least 10 days to do all these analyses well enough. So if you consider these systems that have an ancient radius above one hexagon, you can typically go to La Silla and just use the same conditions there that are, well, the conditions that are now used to follow up the lensed quasars, and also use the current tools to do the deblending of different images. So all of that should be fine. Yeah.
Okay. So can I continue, Carlo? Or?
Yeah, yes, please. Until someone else will raise their hand.
Okay. Also, I was wondering whether the point you made about the chromatic effects for microlensing. So could you turn the problem around and get some insights on the IMF or the typical stellar mass for your stars that produce the microlensing? Is it...
it's a very good question. I always had this in mind, and never pushed enough. So I actually don't know. So in the microlensing simulations, people do, as you probably know, right now they mostly fix the IMF in all cases.
Yeah.
So you vary the kappa value, you vary the smooth matter fraction, but the IMF is always kept fixed. Which would be fine enough. I think there are some studies that just try to move from the most common IMFs and didn't see any major difference in statistics, at least. But when you turn the problem around, how to constrain the IMF from that, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, perhaps it's a bit oversold to phrase it that way, but just to get. The mean stellar mass to height ratio is already.
When you go to the papers on IPTF 16GU, so here everyone know that there is a strong microlensing effect that explains the brightness of this image compared to the others. And I think the authors were mainly using that to probe the different stellar dust extinction in the lens rather than other effects. And I have to go back, but I'm not really sure here. I think you can go to these references if you want to see why they prefer to constrain differential dust extinction compared to the mass to light ratio. But I think there are a lot of many challenges.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so another point. So the selection of the static lenses that you perform with simulations and some also actual data, I guess. Do you know whether you could be biased against or toward the presumably star forming host galaxies, and would that have an impact on the occurrence of supernovae that will explode? And is it taken into account or?
So in our case, the selection of static lenses we want is really specific. We want static galaxy lenses that have wide image separations to do all these studies. And we ideally want to select all of them with high completeness, regardless of the nature of the background galaxy. So we don't, in principle, want to be biased to star forming galaxies. If there are some quiescent galaxies with type 1a in there, we want to find them ideally. But as you can expect in deep learning, when you bias your training data, you will of course bias the predictions. So as you mentioned, in this version at least, we have lensed sources that are mostly blue, as in nature, that are mostly star forming, as in nature also. And so the predictions would end up to let's say give low scores to the red lensed sources that are more quiescent, and so this network would probably exclude them. But the tests we then did on HSC, so with real data from HSC, show that if you if you design the lens simulations in another way, so if you force the source color to be more uniform, let's say to have a uniform distribution of colors for the sources, then the predictions tend to be more stable. So you can recover better both the blue and red lens sources. So this is our hope that these new networks, they would give us a high score for all galaxy-galaxy lenses, regardless of their precise nature. But of course, at the same time, we would have a few contaminants. And yeah, so yeah, that's the idea, yeah.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Any more questions, Ralph?
Well, if you insist, I have one.
Is there any other comment by someone else or no question? I don't see any rise then, so please go ahead.
Yeah, so the optimal strategy that you came up with for supernovae, is it in line with the optimal strategy that you would infer for lens quasar? So there is no competition here for tension, I would say, between the strategies or?
For the selection here,
yeah,
in LSST,
here.
So the strategy that would give the most, the discovery of
the
higher number of lens supernovae and comparison with lens quasars, that I don't know. I think it shouldn't matter so much because the lens quasars are definitely so much brighter. That I don't think you would change the rates of lens quasar discoveries by such a high factor here between the different strategies, but I don't have a direct comparison in mind. I don't think actually that people did the same study for lens quasars, including micro lensing, with all the different LSST strategies, but it could be, For lens quasars, I would just like to remind you that you have other techniques, as you know, that you can also select the lens quasars from the blended light curves. They are so bright that you can also do different selection methods. So there are many complementary selection methods for lens quasars that make these kind of analysis very complex. So here we cannot really compare directly.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I think I will stop asking questions.
Thanks for the questions.
Eric, please.
Hey. Hello, Raoul. I had a question regarding the Schultz work about modeling with machine learning tools. So can you tell me if there are some, in your opinion, if there are some, what are the limitations? Because you know also lens tools. So how do you see the evolution of this type of methods?
Yeah, so the very interesting question. So maybe I can just mention first that so that the sentence I said that the predictions of time delays is good enough. These predictions is about good enough at the level of let's say 20% in relative error. And so in the end, when we will need the final model for cosmography on these individual systems, we will need always to go back to space-based imaging and to MCMC approach, I think in the end, to get to constrain all parameters and all to compare also different mass profiles, to constrain the contributions from the environment and all of that, we will definitely need to go back to MCMC. So in this case, this neural network modeling is done for quick analysis to help us guide the follow-up. And following that, your question by comparing this neural network to MCMC, I think the tricky part in CNN analysis and CNN modeling of lenses is always these biases that you can put on the network predictions that depend on the way you really define the training data. So this is always tricky to test. As you know, these are black boxes. And so you have to ask many questions to your train network to really make sure it's correct. And so this is really the challenge. So I think, in my opinion, the challenge is to design test sets that make sure the final networks are not biased in one way or another. So we can improve on this test set. But in the end, I think we'll have, in all cases, the need to be very careful.
Okay.
As a follow-up, again, I mentioned that Stefan is now finishing another paper where he is comparing all the model predictions from CNN with the classical MCMC approach on real systems from the Sugoi sample in HSC. So he's discussing here these kind of effects. So the paper should be out in a few months maximum. And yeah. I think it should. It would be the first direct comparison of these two approaches, and so, yeah, I think you will probably be interested in that.
Yeah, I have a look. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Well, I think that we can stop here and thank you again, Raul, for this stimulating talk. And let me advertise next week, Cafe Club. The speaker will be Mary Poletta from Bologna, and she will talk about the spectroscopic observation of PHZG237.01, a galaxy protocluster at redshift 2.16 in the Cosmos field. And that's it. See you next week for Cafe Club.
Thanks a lot, everyone. Bye-bye.
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 Bye, everyone. Bye.